Hello everybody, welcome back to the Journal Club. Last week I shared a paper with you about the effect of photoperiod, which is the length of daylight, on our primary reward and motivation pathway in the brain. Photoperiod affects the release and uptake of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, which is a brain region that consolidates multiple inputs and drives action when it comes to reward-associated behaviors. To be more specific with the results from last week, long photoperiods, which is 16 hours of daylight and 8 hours of darkness, leads to enhanced dopamine release and uptake in the nucleus accumbens of female mice. That's right. I should not forget that this effect of daylight is actually sex-specific and is not seen in male mice. You may ask, Happy, why is this important? This is important because we have reports of mood disorder like depression in the winter days where there is short photoperiod. And understanding how light affects emotion and mental health at the molecular and cellular level will allow us to treat these conditions better. There might be some components that we can target with a drug, or there are also behavioral actions that we can take that have zero costs. That's what we talked about last week. And if you have not listened to the Journal Club, I strongly suggest that you listen to it because it's one of the foundational papers for my personal graduate work at Vanderbilt University. And many more journal clubs will be about that topic. I promise to update you as I learn more. But for today, I have the second foundational paper for my project. I mentioned last week that there are three papers that I'm sharing with you now. And today's journal club will be the second in this series. Today's paper comes from the McMahon Lab at Vanderbilt University, and it was published back in 2015. The first author on the paper is Noah Green. The title of the paper is Photoperiod Programs Dorsal Raphe Serotonergic Neurons and Affective Behaviors. Most of the introduction and the experiment setup from last week carries through for today's paper, but there are a few new terms and concepts that I would like to share with you before I tell you what the data tell us. Last week's journal club focused on the dopamine system, which is the most popular system when it comes to positive valence. Valence is this very niche term in neuroscience and also used in psychology that classifies the emotional state into positive or negative. Positive valence is a state of pleasant emotions that are rewarding and fulfilling. And negative valence is the opposite, and it refers to an emotional state of unpleasantness and aversion. It is not directly relevant to our discussion today, but I should mention here that valence has nothing to do with the intensity of the emotional state. Think of it like the number line going towards the positive and the negative direction. And in fact, that's how it's often depicted in figures in neuroscience and psychology textbooks. And there's a separate understanding to the intensity of both positive and negative states, and we'll get to talk about it in a different journal club. But valence is just this term that describes negative and positive emotional states. Bringing you back to the idea of positive valence, the dopamine system, like I said, is super important and relevant to describe positive valence. Another system that is also equally relevant is the serotonin system. Serotonin, like dopamine, is a neuromodulator in the brain. It's also present in the body, but we'll focus on brain serotonin for today. Nowadays, on popular science, especially on social media, the dopamine system is portrayed as the reward and sort of the actor behind hedonic pleasure, while the serotonin system is portrayed as the actor behind fulfillment and satisfaction. I say this from my own experience on social media and science communication. I listen to health and lifestyle-oriented content on social media, and the presenters often give relatively more grace and distinction for the serotonin system because we think of it as the modulator for satisfaction. And the rationale here is that we value fulfillment more than pleasure. And there is some merit to that, but it's not completely true. Often the two systems work hand in hand together to influence our affective state and overall our emotional state. But that notion of serotonin as the molecule of satisfaction is heavily backed by the use of selective serotonin receptor inhibitors, the SSRIs, which are prescription drugs for major depressive disorder, and their ability to increase serotonin at the synapse, at the cell level, has given them some utility for a lot of patients. So we already know the importance of the serotonin system in modulating our mood and emotions. With that said about serotonin and its relevance, last week we said dopamine is primarily produced in the ventral tegmental area, so there's some localization to its production, and the same is true for serotonin. The majority of the brain serotonin is produced by serotonergic neurons in the raphe nucleus. In neuroscience, we name neurons based on the neurotransmitter or neuromodulator they produce. If they produce, say, dopamine, we call them dopaminergic. And if they produce serotonin, we call them serotonergic. And in the brain of most mammals, the serotonin neurons are localized in a region called the RAF nucleus, which is located in the midbrain. And these neurons extend their axons and innervate both the cortical regions of the brain and also the subcortical structures. These serotonergic neurons have spontaneous electrical activity. In other words, this means that they fire, and from the firing, there will be serotonin released from the end of the neuron projections from the axons. In addition to this spontaneous activity, serotonergic neurons also receive input from other regions of the brain. So much relevant to today's journal club, these serotonergic neurons receive input from the master clock of the brain, called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. I talked about this master clock on last week's journal club, so I won't get into too much detail for today, but it's a region that synchronizes all the body's molecular clocks and sets our circadian rhythm. And one of the targets for this master clock is the serotonergic neurons in the raphe nucleus. So an environmental stimuli that affect the master clock will alter the inputs to the serotonergic neurons and affect their electrical activity. The main environmental stimulus is light. The master clock is super sensitive to light. Our eyes, our retina, send direct signal to cue this master clock. So it's a very logical hypothesis to say that photoperiod, which is the length of daylight, will indirectly affect the electrical activity of the serotonergic neurons in the dorsal raphe nucleus and the subsequent serotonin signaling in the brain. And that is exactly the hypothesis that was tested in today's paper. The question is, how does the length of daylight affect serotonergic activity in the brain and the associated affective state? That should be good intro for today's paper. Let me briefly describe the study setup and the methods for today's paper, and then we can talk about the results and what they mean. Like last week's experiments, this study was conducted with C3H mice that were specifically bred to remove the retina degeneration that is often seen in this strain of mice. So these mice have healthy vision, and they also produce melatonin, which is the most important hormone when it comes to timekeeping in the body. There were three groups of mice based on photoperiod: the short, equinox, and long photoperiods. The short photoperiod is like winter days with 8 hours of light and 16 hours of darkness, while the long photoperiod mimicked summer-like days with 16 hours of light and 8 hours of darkness. The equinox condition is in between the long and short photoperiods. It has 12 hours of light and 12 hours of darkness. And the mice were bred and raised under these conditions until the age of 2 to 3 months before they were used for experiments. When it comes to technique, there are two electrophysiological tools used in today's paper. The first tool is a multi-electrode array. A multi-electrode array is an electrophysiology tool that has a small bed of electrodes. So just imagine a grid of tiny electrodes in the millimeter scale poking out like a bed of nails. And you can slice a brain with the dorsal raphe nucleus and place it on the bed of electrodes. And the electrodes will record the electrical potential generated by the neurons when the neurons are firing. And I should mention here that the brain slice is kept alive by continuous perfusion of oxygenated artificial cerebrospinal fluid. With this technique, you can record, let's say, for 5 minutes and see what the electrical activity is present in that slice, and then analyze that data to get the frequency of firing from those neurons. You can also add drugs and chemicals to the continuous perfusion to see how the neurons respond to that drug. And the research team does that for some of the experiments, so we'll talk about it later. The other electrophysiological technique that was used in this study is whole cell patch clamp. And it's a long and fancy name, but it's very similar to the previous technique. What is different here is that you can only record from one neuron at a single time. And in this technique, the recording electrode is dipped in a glass pipette with some internal solution to mimic the intracellular environment of the neuron. And that pipette is used to patch the neuron, which is a very technical term to describe the injection of the neuron with the pipette and forming a tight seal while getting access to the neuron and measuring how the flow of ions and recording the electrical activity of the neuron. These neuroscience techniques are very hard to describe with just words, and I'll probably lose a lot of you by now, but take my word for today. And in the near future, I'll share with you what these techniques actually look like. With that said about methods, let's dive into the results from this paper. The first thing that we see is that the firing rate of the serotonergic neurons from the long photoperiod group is higher than both the short photoperiod and the equinox photoperiod. The firing rate is a measure of electrical activity. It is given in action potentials per second, and the long photoperiod mice have almost double the firing rate of both the short photoperiod and equinox conditions. And I should add here that there is no difference between the short and equinox photoperiods, and the increase is only seen in mice that were raised in the long photoperiod conditions. The research team determined that this increase is coming from the intrinsic excitability of these neurons, and to check this, they patched. I'm using electrophysiology lingo here to refer to that second technique I mentioned earlier. So they patched onto some of these neurons and found that their resting membrane potential is significantly higher. Resting membrane potential is the electrical potential or voltage of the membrane of these neurons when they are not firing. The typical membrane potential often ranges between negative 70 and positive 40 millivolts. And as neurons fire, they produce action potentials. And this membrane, during action potentials, this membrane potential increases from negative 70 to positive 40 millivolts and comes back to negative 70. Often the resting membrane potential, which is the time before firing is initiated, ranges between negative 50 and negative 70 millivolts. And the long photoperiod serotonergic neurons are resting at around negative 60 millivolts, while the short and equinox neurons are resting around negative 70 millivolts. This difference is important because the negative 60 millivolt neurons can fire action potentials with a small increase in voltage, while the short and equinox neurons will require additional electrical current to make up for that 10 millivolt difference in resting potential. And that is what we see when we do a current clamp and inject specific amounts of electrical current into these neurons. The serotonergic neurons from the long photoperiod conditions will have more firing rate than the other two conditions for the same amount of current injected. I recognize that electrophysiology is a very niche concept, and I still do not have the language to describe it to someone who does not have the necessary background in neuroscience. However, I'll go ahead and give you a one-sentence summary of the results from Figure 1. Serotonergic neurons from long photoperiod mice have higher firing frequency, and that is due to their intrinsic nature. In line with that result, the mice that were raised under long photoperiod conditions also have higher serotonin and higher norepinephrine in their midbrains. These are both neurotransmitters that are relevant for this system, and the increased firing led to their increased concentration in the midbrain of these mice. When the mice were put through behavioral tasks to measure any effects on affective states like depression and anxiety, the long photoperiod mice showed lower depression and anxiety symptoms in those tasks, which tells us that the molecular and cellular results that we talked about so far are also displayed at the behavioral level. One thing here, I have said this before and I'll repeat it again and again. I love the different layers to neuroscience research. The levels of readout in neuroscience is just remarkable. We can talk about things at the cellular level, things that we cannot see with the naked eye. At the same time, we can talk about how the animals behave as an organism due to the molecular and cellular things that we describe. And this gives a great deal of confidence in the work. Going back to the paper, the long photo period mice do better with tasks that test for depression and anxiety when compared to the short and equinox photo period mice. However, there was no difference between the scores of the short photo period and the equinox conditions. So the results are very selective for the long photo period condition. The research team then asked an interesting question. We see that photo period affects the serotonin pathway, but what happens if we change the photo period during adulthood? So they followed the same three photo period conditions as I described earlier until the mice were a month old, and then shifted their photo period to the opposite condition for the next month before running the tests again. I'll elaborate on that. There's a great deal of development in the critical period, which is the first 3 to 4 weeks of a mouse's life. This is a time when the brain goes through massive development. And so it's important to know if the effect of photo period is limited to this stage of development compared to the experience during adulthood. So the mice were raised in one photo period condition for a month before being moved into a different condition. So, for example, if they were in the long photo period for the first month, they were moved to a short photo period at 30 days for another month, and vice versa. After the photo period swap, the first rate of the serotonergic neurons was compared to our previous measurements, where the photo period was kept constant for the entire 2 to 3 month period. The results were very interesting because the firing rate of the serotonin neurons did not change when the photo period was swapped. If the mice were in the long photo period for the first 30 days, then the firing rate of their serotonergic neurons is programmed by those 30 days and not affected by the shift in photo period. The same is true for the short photo period mice. Mice that were raised in the short photo period condition will sustain the low firing rate despite a change to long photo period after 30 days of development. And the firing rates match the frequencies that were recorded in the earlier experiments that do not involve a change in photo period. From this, we learned that developmental photo period programs the activity of serotonin neurons, and a change in photo period during adulthood, later in early adulthood, will not affect the firing rate of the serotonin neurons. The last experiment conducted in this study was to look at the relevance of melatonin and the effect of photo period on serotonergic neurons, because we know that the hormone melatonin can stop the firing of serotonergic neurons in the raphe nucleus. So the research team measured the firing rate of the serotonergic neurons from mice that were a knockout for the melatonin receptor 1. These mice will have melatonin, but they lack the site for melatonin binding, so there is no melatonin signaling through the melatonin receptor 1. In these mice, photo period did not affect the firing rate of the serotonergic neurons, like we saw earlier. All mice had similar firing rates for their serotonergic neurons. And on top of that, the amount of serotonin and norepinephrine in the midbrain was the same across the three photo period conditions. And all the mice had comparable performance in behavioral tasks that tested depression and anxiety. So from this, we learned that melatonin signaling is important for the effect of photo period on serotonin activity in the brain and any of the associated affective behaviors. That was the summary of the results from this paper. The length of daylight affects serotonin signaling in the brain, and that is relevant for changes in seasonal affect. Longer days have antidepressive and anxiolytic, which is anti-anxiety effects, compared to shorter winter-like photo period. The big caveat here is that this work is done in mice, and mice are nocturnal. They're active at night and inactive during the day, which is the complete opposite of humans, as humans are active in the day and inactive at night. We still learn a lot from these rodent studies because human data for seasonal affective disorder is very much in line with these findings in mice. That was it for today. I will share the links to today's paper and the webpage of the McMahon Lab under the episode notes so that you can look into it more. Next week, I'll share another paper, the third paper that is relevant for my project. And I'll also tell you how the three papers come together to form our current understanding on the effect of photoperiod on positive valence. Until next week, ciao.